I know in the Bible we have quite a few big concepts that summarize much of what God has done. I think if we had to sit back and say words that we think would do well to summarize the gospel, love, we know from John 3:16 that God's motivation for doing what he did, and I say that, it's not just that he created us, but he had the foreknowledge that we would sin, that we would go against him. And instead of saying, well, it's going to happen and just let it happen or change things up where we had to obey, we could not choose, he actually made a plan. Ephesians 1 makes clear that the plan was set up even before the foundation of the world. And so love is an easy word. Grace comes to mind. I would think hope, you know, there's really no sense of what hope is until the gospel comes along and gives us that hope. The word that I want to talk about tonight, and I'm not saying this one word is better than all the others, but mercy. Mercy, I think, very well summarizes some of the things that the gospel message is about. As I have here, Romans 1:31, where Paul is basically assessing the Gentile world, and he says, they're senseless, faithless, heartless, merciless. Some English translations use the word ruthless, and I think that's probably just as well as merciless, but we understand people who act without mercy. And it seems that we live in a world that is ruthless, right? Yeah. But again, as I've said many times before, the world we live in today is not unlike the world of the first century when Paul wrote what he wrote. You can read Romans 8, or rather Romans 1, 18 through 32, and it is pretty much an assessment of our day and time, just like it is in the first century. Jesus said in Matthew 5, verse 7, blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. This is the great concept of the New Testament. You get mercy when you show mercy. So, where I'd like for us to begin is we're talking about being merciful, and this is basically one of the best demonstrations of the gospel. And I'll say this, that I do think sometimes those who criticize Christians are right to say that there does not seem to be a lot of mercy. You know, it's almost like we relish when there are people who are lost in sin. It's like we're excited about that, and it shouldn't be that way ever. We know that Jesus came and he told people he came to seek and save the lost. That doesn't mean he came across every single lost person and just automatically made them go to heaven. The only person you could even think of, I think, that fits that bill somewhat is the thief on the cross, where he tells them, today you'll be with me in paradise. But it's not that Jesus didn't do anything good for anybody else, but it's not like he just went up to people and said, look, you're saved. Just right now, you're saved. We remember the questionable story in John 7:53 through 8, about verse 11, what we call the woman caught in adultery. It's a spurious writing. We don't know when it shows up. It doesn't show up in the oldest manuscripts. It's a story that sounds apocryphal, to be honest with you, because there are just certain clues like him writing in the sand. Why would we need that detail? And honestly, it's funny, there are people who go on in detail as to what Jesus was writing in the sand. We'd have no clue. No clues provided. But you remember what Jesus says to her is, go, sin no more. I don't condemn you. Go and sin no more. He doesn't just let her off the hook. He doesn't just say, all right, you're forgiven. He says, you're forgiven, but then don't go do this anymore. So the idea of mercy, I think, is an important idea. It's one of those things we'll look at in a passage in Mark 3 in just a minute that even in his day and time, people lacked. Now, I didn't know that this was going to happen. I think when I set this up, if it's all the passages, that's fine, but it, you know, what order are we going to take it in? Well, we're doing Luke, Mark, James, Hebrews, Romans, James. I don't know why it set up my thing that way, so it's my fault for fooling around with PowerPoint and I clicked on a thing and there we are. So let's go to Luke 6:27. When Luke talks about the Sermon on the Mount, he never just calls it the Sermon on the Mount. But Luke 6 is basically the Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew, we have it in its fullness of Matthew 5, 6, and 7. It's the longest sermon we have of what Jesus teaches. Luke kind of spreads that out, but the focus of the sermon is in Luke 6. If you start with me there, verse 27, we get it when he says, "I say to you, to those who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. To the one who is striking you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from one who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either." Now, I'll be honest with you. I think verse 29 is probably the hardest to just say what that looks like. I think most of us, if anybody came up to us and hit us in the cheek, that our first response is maybe to defend ourselves, to strike back. But I don't even think that's really for most of us what we would do. If somebody came up and just out of the blue hit us, we would recoil. We would back up. We wouldn't go forward with it. We would back up. We'd go hands up, you know? And what Jesus says here doesn't even fit that bill. It's not, if one strikes you on the cheek, make sure you retreat. He says, to the one who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. Give yourself up. That doesn't seem natural. And honestly, in some ways, as far as defense goes, it doesn't seem smart. You know, someone comes up and hits you, you go, all right, here's the other one. What? I don't know that that's exactly what he's saying. I'm thinking as an illustration of Jesus himself. You remember when the soldiers were mocking him and spitting on him and striking him? He doesn't fight back. He doesn't say anything back. He doesn't threaten them at all. And I think that's kind of what we have here, is that attitude of you just give yourself up. I don't think at all it's this idea that Jesus was there as they struck him and they were like striking him and he's like, all right, you missed a spot. You know, how stupid does that sound? I don't think that's at all what he's saying. So in commentaries, this is another passage, they either don't mention it at all, or they do what I'm doing now and saying, I don't know exactly what this looks like, but what it sounds like is, as Jesus was being beaten, basically, by his captors, and they were mocking him, that he took it. He did not threaten, is what Peter says. He did not threaten. So turn the other cheek. In verse 30, give to everyone who begs from you, and from one who takes away your goods, don't demand them back. And as you wish that others would do to you, the golden rule is what we call this, do so to them. And he goes on to say in verse 32 through 36, if you love those who love you, what is that? What benefit is it? Even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who love, or you do good to those who do good to you, what benefit is that to you? That's him in verse 32 and 33 talking about verse 31. Verse 31, do to others what you would have them do to you. If you only do to others what they're doing to you, which is really what he's saying in verse 32, 33. If you love those who love you, do good to those who do good to you, what benefit is it? Sinners do that. Verse 34, if you lend to those, or if you lend to those from whom you expect to get back, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to get back the same amount. Now, he's not teaching us don't lend anything ever and not ever expect anything, but his point is lend, be generous, but don't expect to get it back. And what I'm trying to say is it's not, you know, this weird thing of, you know, Rick says, can I borrow your pen? And I give him my pen, and in my mind thinking, well, I'm never going to get that back. If he gives me my pen back, I get my pen back. I'm not worried about it. It's not like I'm consumed with the thought of he took something from me. That's the attitude I think Jesus is trying to convey here to us. Love your enemies, he says in verse 35. Do good. Lend, expecting nothing in return. You're not doing it for the return. You're doing it because you love these people. Your reward will be great, and your son, and you'll be sons of the Most High. He is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be merciful, even as your Father is merciful. That's the essence of the law, is mercy, I think. I don't know where we could turn to a passage that says exactly that, that the essence of the law is mercy. But this is what Jesus is teaching here. Loving our enemies and doing good without expecting anything to come back to us good. You know, the karma idea of, you know, what you give is what you get. He doesn't say that here. He says, do what God does. He is kind to the evil. Now, that's not really what seems to be natural. If someone's mean to us, again, it's either we're mean to them back, or we kind of step back and recoil. We stay away, you know? And I get that. I understand that. But that's not what he's saying here. He's saying, for those who are going to be followers of God, we want to be kind the way God is, which is kindness to those who are ungrateful. Not just to people who don't say thank you, but people who really are ungrateful. I mean, it's like they feel like you're doing what you're doing because they deserve it, right? And Jesus says, do it anyway. Be merciful even as your Father is merciful. And I'm going to tell you, this isn't easy. Look in Mark 3. Mark 3. This is a story I really enjoy. Mark 3, 1 through 6, where he is emphasizing his compassion, his mercy. Compassion is another word for mercy. In some contexts, we'll look at Matthew 18 in a minute, but that's the word. It's either translated pity or compassion or mercy, but it's all the same thing. Here in Mark 3, 1, again, Jesus entered the synagogue, and a man was there that had a withered hand. And they watched Jesus. I mean, this is really kind of funny. If we're watchers watching the watchers, we're watching the Pharisees, we're watching these Jewish religious leaders as they watch Jesus. It's a Sabbath. Here's the synagogue. And they're watching Jesus. They're not paying attention to much of anything other than him. He's their focus. And there's a man with a withered hand, and they're watching Jesus to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath so that he might accuse him. They're not impressed that Jesus can heal anybody. They're impressed whether he does this on the Sabbath. They're wanting to catch him. They're wanting to catch him. It's a trap to them that they think they've set. And the whole purpose in verse 2 is that they would accuse him. They're wanting to accuse him. They're watching Jesus. And this is to them not just entertainment, but this is a way to get Jesus. And so he said to the man with the withered hand, come here. He brings him out in front of everybody to watch. And he said to them, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or do harm? I'm going to tell you, that's a softball question. We know the answer to it. You don't have to think about that. What is it? I mean, is it ever right to do wrong? No. So on the Sabbath day, is it right to do right or wrong? Right, always. To save or kill? Always save, not kill. But it says at the end of verse 4, they were silent. And he looked around at them with anger. You remember we read in the passage where Peter betrays Jesus 3 times. Jesus had told him the night before, you know, you're not going to be able to even get to the point of dying for me before the cock crows. You're going to deny me 3 times. And when the cock crowed, Peter looks at Jesus across the way. And I don't know what that look of Jesus was toward Peter, but Peter went away weeping, and we're told his weeping was bitter. Ugly cry is what I think if I was putting it in modern terminology. So can you imagine Jesus angry with them? It's not just that he's looking around at them. He is looking at them with anger, grieved. I mean, his heart aches at their hardness of heart. And he then says to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. An undoubted miracle. Notice the Pharisees. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians, which, by the way, these aren't people who get along. They don't root for the same team. They're actually against each other. But now they have a common enemy in Jesus, and it says that they got together to figure out how to destroy Jesus. Why? What was the whole point of him being destroyed? Because he did this on the Sabbath. He did what? He showed compassion. He showed mercy. He did the right thing on the right day, which was every day. Whether it was the Sabbath or not, but they had elevated the Sabbath over everything. The Sabbath was most important over the commands of God. Well, Jesus deals with that quite a bit in the book of Mark. As you go, let's turn to James 2. James 2. James spends quite a bit of time on the very idea of mercy. Verses 1 through 13, actually, he is very focused on mercy. If you look at James and you look at the very end of chapter 1, he's talking about what is true religion. And he says in verse 27, religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to visit or care for orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world. So with that concept in mind, he says, my brothers, show no partialities. You hold the faith in our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory. If a man wearing a gold ring and fine clothing comes into your assembly, and also a poor man in shabby clothing comes in. And the way I would illustrate it, I mean, we get this. Somebody shows up coming into the building and they're not only dressed nice. I know for probably a lot of us, it's not just that somebody is dressed sharply. They smell nice, right? And I'm saying that because I'm not saying that may impress us one way or the other. Like, this is a religious person. He's a good guy because he smells nice. But if a guy's a sharp dresser and he smells nice, you're like, man, this guy, he's put together. This is good. We want him to be impressed with us. We want him to be impressed by us. And right behind him is a guy who has shabby clothing and he smells bad. I don't know about you. I mean, that puts me off. A guy walks up and he talks to me and he smells bad. You're like, phew. So I'm kind of adding that into our focus here, but all James is talking about is people who got nice clothes, have gold rings, and a guy who doesn't. If you pay attention, verse 3, to the one who's wearing the fine clothing, you say, you sit here in a good place. And say it as a poor man, you can stand over there. or maybe, here, you can sit down on my feet. Like you're doing him a favor, right? You're doing this guy a favor because you're letting him sit at your feet. What you're doing is showing partiality, is what James is telling us here. Have you not, verse 4, then made distinctions among yourselves, become judges with evil thoughts? It's not just that you're judging people based on what they look like, one looking nice, one looking bad. You're judging with evil thoughts. Listen, my beloved brothers, has not God chosen those who are poor in the world to be rich in faith, heirs of the kingdom which he has promised to those who love him? I mean, honestly, the wealthier people get, the less likely they are to believe in God. Their wealth is their God. They believe they've gotten it themselves. I mean, I've had people tell me stuff like that. I mean, honestly, that one guy really kind of blew my mind one time. It was the same guy who wanted me to beg him to be baptized. He said, I've had studies with folks, people like, this guy, I think he's ready and whatever. So I sit there and I talk to him. And this guy kind of blew my mind, really, truly blew my mind. We were in Virginia, and I asked him, because I sometimes ask people, what's keeping you from being baptized? If you know baptism and all. And he goes, well, I'm just wanting someone to beg me. And that's honestly what he said. I got up and left. I didn't know what else to do. That blew my mind. I don't know if he really wanted me to get on my knees, maybe? I don't know. He didn't say that. He just said, I'm waiting for someone to beg me. And I basically, as I was walking out, I said, look, if Jesus hanging on a cross isn't enough for you, that's God's begging, there's nothing that's going to do it. And I don't know the end of the story. Nobody was mad at me about it. I didn't know. I didn't really care if they were mad at me about it. But I've never had that kind of hubris of, I just want somebody to beg me. He was the same guy who would talk about his wealth that he had nothing to thank God for. It was all, he did it. He got the job. He did that. Who gave him the ability to do what he did? I don't even remember what he did. It wasn't anything that, was like medical to save lives. But all I'm trying to say is this person was all about himself. The rich don't really have that place. It's not that no rich people. Abraham was a rich man. He was faithful. You have Joseph. He was a rich man, Joseph of Arimathea, specifically who I was thinking of, but Joseph, coat of many colors Joseph, back in the Egyptian days. You know, he was number two in all the kingdom. So being wealthy is not the problem. Job was wealthy. That's not what I'm trying to say. I'm just saying, typically, the wealthier people are, the less likely they are to depend on God. And so, verse 6, James says, you've dishonored the poor man. Are not the rich ones the ones who oppress you? The ones who drag you into court? Are they not the ones who blaspheme that honorable name by which you're called? If you really fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you're doing well. But if you show partiality, you're committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. Forever keeps the whole law, but he fails in one point, he's become guilty of it all. He who said don't commit adultery also said don't murder. If you don't commit adultery, but you do murder, you become a transgressor of the entire law. Think of the law in this particular illustration as a whole piece. It's like a big piece of glass. That's one illustration I read that I like, where if you have, you know, you're moving it. Let's say you're moving it out of the back end of the truck, moving it into your house, and you bump into a wall, and you put a crack into this big piece. Maybe this glass is going to be your tabletop, right? I mean, I remember how popular it was to have just a solid glass tabletop. So you're moving the glass and you bang into something and it puts a little crack. What do you do? Now some people will go, we'll just put something on top of it. We'll hide it, right? We'll still use it. I paid for it. It's mine. Some people are going to take it back. I don't want a broken piece of glass. Because you know when it starts breaking, what happens? It's going to continue, that crack. If you've seen on a windshield of any sort of car, those little tiny cracks that are like a millimeter or two, what happens over a little bit of time? Yeah, they grow. I mean, and the funniest one I ever had, I forget what vehicle we had, but it was in a place where we lived. It was cold, and I didn't think about it. We had a crack. We knew there was a little crack, and I turned the defroster on, which put all this, there was cold air, obviously, because it's cold. We turned the defroster on, which is hot air, and went right up against that crack, and guess what happened? That crack literally in a second went phew. It was huge. It went from like, I don't know what it was, an inch or two to like 2 feet. Well, I mean, you know, thankfully we replace it through insurance and whatnot, but you replace it. The law is expressed in a way that if you break just one part of it, you're breaking the entire thing. And that's the law of Moses, not the law of faith, by the way. So in verse 7, are they not the ones who blaspheme you? You know, if you're going to really fulfill the royal law, he goes on in verse 9, if you show partiality, you're committing sin, you're convicted by the law. And we read on, I'm sorry, let's go to verse 12. And so speak and so act as those who are being judged under the law of liberty. For judgment is without mercy to the one who shows no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. Like I said, we'll look in Matthew 18 here in just a minute, but, you know, if we don't show mercy, why in the world are we expecting mercy? And that's kind of the question that we have here before us with all this. Look over in Hebrews 2, just go back a little bit from where we are, in James 2 to Hebrews chapter 2. Look at verse 17 and 18 when he's been talking about Jesus sharing in flesh and blood. Verse 17, therefore he had to be made like his brothers in every respect. Jesus was like us, so that he might become a merciful. Become what? Not just some high priest of some order of Melchizedek, like he says later, but that Jesus would be a merciful and faithful high priest. And that's the point. Jesus was not just faithful to God, he was a merciful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people, because he himself has suffered when tempted. He is actually able to help those who are being tempted. His humanity made him merciful. What does our humanity do? I know what we do. We judge, right? And it's kind of an automatic thing. Look back in Romans 5, verses 6 through 11. Great passage here where God tells us the gospel in just a few verses. I know the word gospel is not used here in Romans chapter 5 verses 6 through 11, but this is pretty much an essence of it. While we were still helpless, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. So in verse 6, 8, and 10, you can look at the even numbers, 6, 8, 10, he calls us ungodly, and then in verse 8, we're sinners, and then in verse 10, we're enemies. So what did God do? While we were weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. He didn't die for the godly. And he didn't die for the ungodly who became godly. He died for the ungodly while they were ungodly. One will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare even to die. And by the way, good, using God's definition, is himself. You remember the rich young ruler comes to Jesus and says, "Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus turns it right back on him and says, "Why do you call me good? There's only one good, that is God." Jesus didn't say, "I'm not God." He's saying very clearly, there's only one. Why are you calling me good? Because you recognize I am God. There's only one who's good. That's the definition that's being used here. We would die for somebody like Jesus, would we not? Yes. Would I die for me? No. So as we go on here, he says in verse 10, if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son, much more now that we've been reconciled shall we be saved by his life. Much more than that, we rejoice in God through our Lord, through whom we've now received reconciliation. So God shows his love. He shows his mercy. He shows his compassion. Why? Or I wouldn't say why, but how. The how is through what he did for us through Jesus. We are the ungodly. We are the sinners. We are the enemies. And we don't do that. I mean, we might. You remember in Romans 12, I don't have the passage here in front of you, but in Romans 12, close to the end of Romans 12, Paul says, if your enemy is hungry, laugh in his face, right? I mean, that's kind of what we'd want to do. We'd want to laugh at him, or we might even rub it in his face that we have this juicy steak or whatever. You really would like to rub in the face of your enemy and say, this is really good. Or spill it all out. You know, I've seen TV shows where somebody's dying of thirst and the enemy's got like a canteen of water and he drinks it all. Or he drinks some of it and swashes it in his mouth and spits it out. Like, you know, he's just making fun of the enemy. He's rubbing it in their face. That seems almost natural. It's not. God doesn't want us to be that way at all. So like I say in Romans 12, he tells us, if your enemy's hungry, you feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. That's how you heap coals of fire on his head. Finally, in this list of passages, James 5, verse 11. Back to the book of James. And again, emphasizing the mercy. As we read in James chapter 2 and verse 13, mercy is given to the one who shows mercy. If you don't show mercy, you don't get mercy. That's my way of stating, I guess, how James puts it much more eloquently. But James 2:13 again, judgment is without mercy to one who shows no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. And then just a couple pages over there in chapter 5 and in verse 11. James 5 and verse 11. I'll tell you something. Come on. There we are. We consider those blessed who remain steadfast. And he's talking about as we go through suffering and patience. I think most of us, and I don't know if this is more so, it's probably amplified because of social media, things like Facebook and Twitter and whatever, because we have a larger audience to complain to. But it's easier now to complain. You know, we have things go bad. We let everybody know. I had a bad day today. You know, and then we get a lot of people who, it'll get better. I don't know why we do that. Why we tell everybody what a bad day we've had. Paul says don't complain. And I think Christians do. It's easy to complain. The society we live in is a complaining society. We have so much to be thankful for, do we not? As wealthy Americans. And we find everything to complain about. I mean, people fall apart because they ordered a hamburger and they got a cheeseburger. You know? I mean, I've seen people in line fall apart, like angry fall apart. And just explode on the world because it's not going right. I'm like, what happened? They put cheese on my hamburger. Take it off. Or be a human and walk up and say, my order's wrong. And they'll fix it for you. I mean, no. We got to let everybody in on it. So that's not right. Here in James 5:11, he's talking about that kind of attitude. And he says in verse 11, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You've heard of the patience or the steadfastness of Job. Job didn't sit around just waiting on God. He kept demanding God's presence and God's answer. He says, you've seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. I don't know about you, but the story of Job doesn't sound like a merciful, compassionate story at first. It doesn't. Not till you get to the end when God doesn't just tell Job, you're not me, you're Job, you know? I'm God, I have got all this under control. He actually, at the very end, blesses Job to have more than all that he had before. The 10 children he lost, he got 10 new children who were, as the Bible expresses it, his daughters were more beautiful than all other daughters. So the bottom line is, he blessed him, which is what James says. If you think about it, you see the purpose of the Lord, that God is ultimately and always compassionate and merciful. So in Matthew 18, the story I've been kind of intimating here, this is where, in the context of speaking to a brother who has sinned against you, not just somebody who, you know, ruffles your feathers or bothers you. I think sometimes we get that a little mixed up. They've sinned against you. You go and you tell them. And that's what he says there starting in verse 15. If your brother sins against you, go tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens, you've gained your brother. If he doesn't, take one or two with you that every charge would be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. If he refuses listening to them, tell it to the church. If he refuses to listen to the church, then let him be to you like a Gentile and a tax collector. Truly, I say, whatever you bind on earth will have been bound in heaven. This is what he said to Peter individually. He now says to all the apostles in verse 18. Then in verse 19, again I say, if two of you agree on earth about anything they ask, it'll be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, I'm there in their midst. Well, Peter comes up. This is a Petrine thing to do. Come up and ask Jesus a question. Lord, how often? This isn't a bad question, by the way. This is actually a question, as I read this, I'm thinking, how often should I do this? I'm not kidding. So Peter is thinking the way I'm thinking here. How often should this happen? And I forgive him. He sins against me and I forgive him. How often? And Jesus says, as many as seven times. When Luke tells this, he tells it a little differently, where Jesus says, I tell you, if your brother sins against you seven times in a day, and seven times in the day says, I repent, you're supposed to forgive him. Here it's a little different. How often is my brother sinning against me and I forgive him? Up to seven times, basically. And Jesus says, I'm not telling you seven times, but 70 times seven. The number is not the significant thing. I know some translations say something different. ESV actually says 77. It all has to do with Greek and numbers. And by the way, Greek, it's really hilarious. Greek is not good with numbers. It's not. It's a really weird thing. They didn't write numbers the way we do. We can write a number out, and it doesn't matter what language. Whether you speak Spanish, English, Japanese, you see the number, you know the number. Number four is four. In Greek, they wrote out the words. And sometimes they used abbreviations. And sometimes the abbreviations don't match with words that don't match to the number. And I'm just letting you know, there are a few times when numbers seem weird, and this is one of those examples. It really does indicate 490, not 77. But the point is an exaggeration, hyperbole. Jesus isn't saying to Peter, look, you need to keep up. So if your brother sins against you 489 times, get excited because 490 is coming. And after that's 491, when you let him have it. I've known people, by the way, who I think would love that to be the truth, who keep up with it all. That's not what Jesus is saying here. Verse 23, the kingdom of heaven is going to be like a king who wished to settle accounts with his servants. I know I've told this often enough, and I'm sure you know this well enough, where the king find somebody who owes him 10,000 talents, which in our money, we don't talk this way. This comes up, if you think about time that it would take to pay this back, the way it works is 200,000 years to pay this debt back. You know, sometimes people commit crimes and they're told that the sentence for their crime, they've been found guilty, and the judge says, I'm going to pass the judgment that you have to serve five lifetimes. We know actually he's not going to, but the sentence is there. So think you owe the king, and who knows how he ends up owing the king 10,000 talents of money. Talent being a certain weight of money. It would take this person in this time 200,000 years. I don't know about you, it's just like, what? And that's the point. It's an amount of money that is so astronomical, it's silly. And so he orders him and his wife and his children to be taken. And of course the servant, verse 26, falls on his knees implores not a very good word, I like beg. He's begging, have patience with me and I will pay you everything. If the king's already said you owe me 200,000 years, and this guy's saying, look, just be merciful, be compassionate, be pitiful with me, I'll pay you it all. That ain't happening. And in verse 27, out of pity for him, the master of the servant released him and forgave him the debt. All of it just gone, vanished, because the king said so. That's sovereignty, by the way. And when that same servant then went out, verse 28, Jesus tells, he's telling the parable, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. This isn't nothing. Compared to what he owed, it's nothing. So 200,000 years worth versus 3 months, 4 months, basically. It's nothing compared to what he owed. And that's the point. It's not that he's owed nothing. Think about what you make in a month, multiply it times 3 or 4. That's basically what he owes. It's a lot of money. It's not nothing. But it's not what he owed the king. And so instead of going, you know what, I just learned the lesson from the king who I owed all this and couldn't pay, and he was going to throw my wife in jail, my children in jail. Talk about being distressed. And he goes, what? He grabs the guy and starts choking him. And he says in verse 28, pay what you owe. So his fellow servant fell down and pleaded with him, have patience with me and I'll pay you. It's the same words used. He refused. And he went and he put him in prison until he should pay the debt. It's kind of ironic. Now you can't pay because you don't have a job, but you're in jail till, right? Amazing. When his fellow servants heard, they were greatly distressed and went and reported to their master everything that took place. And his master summoned him and said, you wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not have had mercy, which is the same word pity in verse 27, should you not have had mercy on your fellow servant as I had mercy on you? And in anger, his master delivered him to the jailer. So now it's not just you owe 10,000 talents. It's going to take you forever to pay back. Now, I'm sentencing you as an angry judge. I mean, I've heard of judges who are like, look, the law says I have to do this. You know, they're very compassionate in giving a hard sentence. I've heard of people who commit maybe a third-degree felony, and the law, depending on the state, may say the minimum sentence is 5 years of life in jail. And for good behavior, you might end up actually doing 3, but the law says it has to be done. The judge, he can't do anything other than what the law says, and he'll say sometimes something to the effect of, I wish this wasn't it, but this is the law, we have to do this. That's not what this guy is. At this point, it would be like a judge who's like, you know what, I gave you all these chances, you messed them up, and now I'm angry. What about you? I don't think he would go for the minimum. He'd go for the maximum. So here he is angry. And so Jesus' point is verse 35. So also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you. And notice how Jesus says that. It's not, this is what God will do to someone. Leaves it wide open. He says, this is what my Father's going to do to every one of you if you don't forgive your brother from your heart. I know what happens because it's hard. Somebody hurts us. They ask for forgiveness. We know it's hollow. The words mean nothing. But Jesus doesn't say, look, you got to judge whether or not he means it. He doesn't say that. He says, my heavenly Father is going to do this to you if every one of you doesn't forgive your brother from your heart. That's the God we serve. And so as I have here before you, mercy forgives. I want to close with a passage that goes right along with Matthew 18. It's Colossians 3, 12 and 13. We're here in Colossians 3, 12 and 13. Paul says, put on then as God's chosen ones, God's elect, by the way, that's the word that would be used there, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts. That's the first thing he lists. Put on as God's elect, who are holy people, beloved by God, put on compassionate hearts. Are we known to be compassionate? It's easy for us to go, well, I know who isn't compassionate. Nope, this is for each of us to ask ourselves. This is self-examination. Are we compassionate? Are we known for being compassionate? If we're not, we need to assess that. We need to change that. Kindness and humility and meekness and patience, bearing with one another, and if anyone has a complaint against another, forgiving. As the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. Now the language here may not be as strong as what Jesus said in Matthew 18:35, but it's close, isn't it? Again, verse 13, as the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. This is what we're talking about when we started off with just that one word, mercy. Because we live in a time, as Christians, we're supposed to be like lights, right? Jesus said, your light's set on a hill, you know? That's the point. We are lights. We reflect Jesus. Is he merciful? Certainly. We live in a society that's been around for at least 2,000 years where people are senseless, faithless, heartless, merciless. I was reading a month or two ago, it was before the Super Bowl, because the point was, why do we enjoy such violent sports like, you know, football? And this, I think, was right after the young man died on the field and was resuscitated. It was a really good article. The point was, this is all violent. Should we shut it down as a society? Can we shut it down as a society? Which the point was, no, we can't. We like this. We need this, is what the author was trying to say. And one of the points the author said, didn't quote Bible, but came close by saying, we live in a society that is heartless and merciless, and it's easier to cheer it on than to participate. And this is one of the passages that came to mind is Paul in Romans 1:31, because this is what we live in. Christians aren't supposed to be this way. And we know that. It's not that we really have much opportunity to do it. Have you ever, well, let me ask you this. If you ever heard the stories on TV, you know, the bad news where, I'm trying to think of something not so bad, but someone kills someone else's daughter, son, and the family, after the whole process of justice goes through, the judge says, do you as the victims have anything to say to this person? And it blows my mind, and I'm going to get maybe emotional on it just thinking about this. It blows my mind truly. I'm not there where they are, where they get up there and they say, judge, we forgive him. Be merciful to him. What he did was a moment of time, shouldn't define his life. They say things like that, and my mind is blown, my eyes bug out. I'm like, how? At this moment is the moment you want to lay it all on him, right? I would. If they've been found guilty, then yeah. Let's nail them to the wall, if you will. And I'll carry the hammer and the nails, you know? I'm not sure that's the attitude as a Christian we should have. As a matter of fact, what we've been talking about tonight, I don't think Jesus himself would be that way. I don't think Paul would be that way. Stephen certainly wasn't. When he was being stoned to death, while he had been preaching to them the truth, their reaction wasn't, we don't like what you say. It's like, we don't like what we say, or you say. And we don't like you, and we're going to kill you. And they did. And as he was dying, he said, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. I don't know about you. That is immense. It's hard. But in a lot of ways, I do think that's what God is wanting us to be like. So the song that we have is a song of invitation tonight, maybe a song of admonition also. We come to Jesus. I think the more you study about Jesus and everything that he did and everything that he was, it's not easy. I don't think at all there is this point of an easy God that we become easily acquainted with. It's easy for us to understand Him. There are people we're mad at, and we stay mad at, and we feel justified in that, and yet Jesus came to the earth to forgive us. And what did He do? He actually laid His own life down in a horrific way. As He tells the Jews, I lay it down on my own, and I take it up. He could do that. And thankfully, His love motivated Him to do exactly that. So tonight, if you've not been baptized, baptism is what God teaches us, that we are joined in a relationship with Him. We become His children. And if you want to do that, then tonight would be the perfect opportunity. Everything is ready. Please, come forward as we stand and sing.